Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Outcasts with Milk Tray Man David Berry and Odd Job Man Tim Downing. Today on our show, like Darwin's Beagle of 1818, it ups anchor and finds a steady sou'wester and steers towards our outlander Galapagos. We are equipped to bring back the finest, rarest, and most exotic specimens these wild and unknown lands can offer, and boy, oh boy, what a specimen we have here. He's mad, bad, and dangerous to know. You all love to hate him, but we just love him. It's Ed Spaliers! Ladies and gentlemen, Ed, welcome.
Good morning. Welcome. Welcome. Thank you for bringing me on. What a lovely introduction. I would quite like to listen to you tell me tales all afternoon and evening, Tim, if I could. That was.
It can happen. Ed, it's lovely to have you on. Thank you so much for coming on this morning. And as I'm sure you know, one of the things we like to do is we like to read a scene with our guest, and would you like to tell us a little bit about the scene that you have chosen?
I have chosen a scene that I felt was only pertinent because it's the most recent we've seen of Stephen Bonnet, I suppose. It's an introduction to how he has shifted from where he was. Forgive the recycling taking place here in Bristol at the moment. but they are key workers. They're key workers, so they're doing a very good job. I picked a scene because I felt that this was a bit of a character shift for Stephen Bonnet. He's suddenly become, or he is trying to become, a more gentlemanly pirate. And I thought it was a bit of fun. And I also thought, because there is a fight sequence in it, I don't know how these scenes play out when on this podcast, but I've been told there's a bit of fun involved. So I thought maybe if there was a bit of physical action, it would be quite tricky to replicate via audio. I thought that might be interesting. Anyway,
you just wait and see. Okay. You just wait and see. You're going to be pleasantly surprised. Well, you're going to be surprised.
I always like to be surprised.
This is the right place.
Fantastic.
This is the place. Now, what we like to do is we like to divide up our scene. So let's pick some characters. Let's see who would like to play who. Now, would you like to play your namesake, or would you like to mix it up? Would you like to turn your hand to someone else?
Maybe? I would be quite intrigued to see somebody else play Stephen Bonnet, just to see what their interpretation would be.
Fabulous.
Wow. Okay.
And I'm not going to pick. I'm going to leave that to you to fight it out, perhaps.
I'm sensing a wonderful nervousness from David Barry.
Yeah, and nervousness is quite a good place to go, isn't it?
I think so.
I think you pick on the nerves. Exploit the nerves.
Yeah, I'm really getting picked on. All right. Fine.
Yeah. Right. That's going to be tremendous. Absolutely tremendous.
You know it will.
Who else have we got in here? We've got Charles Turnbull and Gerald Forbes. Would you like to take one of those?
I'll go Forbes. Why not? I'll go Forbes. I'll do it.
You're going to go
I'll
Forbes.
I'll give my best Billy Boyd.
Fabulous. I'll go Turnbull in that case. Lovely. And I think, there's a Mr. Marsden.
Yes.
That appears as well. Let's address that when we get to it. I think that'll cause some bit of fun. Yeah. And for the big print, who will take the big print? I'm obviously more than happy to paint the collage.
Tim, I am just so nervous about this character right now. I can't concentrate on anything else. I am going to leave it entirely to you. I'm actually, people won't see this, my palms are actually sweating right now, and I'm not even lying to you. Just take it. Please take whatever you can away from me.
I'm going to take. I'm going to do it. I'm going to take. I'm going to take the big print. I think we should just dive straight in. Because the fourth word on this is prostitutes.
Fantastic.
So let's see. Let's see how this goes. So this is from episode 502. This is scene 33. Interior courtyard, boxing match day. Close on two women, prostitutes, brackets, known as female bruisers. Locked in a ferocious bare-knuckle battle in the midst of a makeshift ring during an underground boxing match, an illicit spectacle. Part grudge match, part sporting contest. We don't know much more background than that. Reveal. A crowd of society gentlemen side by side with the riffraff, the hoi polloi, shouting, swearing, drinking, and wagering on violent sport, which draws patrons from all classes. A bet taker calls out, we don't know his name, calls out the bets as the women attack each other. They are dirty in appearance, wearing raggedy skirts, leather corsets, possibly no shoes. We find Gerald Forbes, wealthy landowner, friend of Jocasta's, from episode 401, the last time I believe we saw him, among the spectators.
Oh, come on, let's have it. Put a bit of strength into it.
Rich, powerful merchant, me, moi, Charles Turnbull approaches and interrupts. Mr. Forbes, I'd like to introduce you to an associate of mine. Forbes turns his attention from the ring to greet the gentleman standing behind Turnbull. Already I'm getting very excited. I hope David is as well.
Yeah.
At what we are about to witness. He carries on. This gentleman is dressed in finery, elegantly groomed, with immaculate manners and an air of affluence. We almost don't recognize him, but there's no mistaking. Oh, yes, there's no mistaking the devil dancing in his eyes. Behold, Stephen Bonnet.
Behold, oh my goodness. It actually says that. Behold,
it
Stephen
actually says
Bonnet.
That. It says that.
Okay.
May I present Mr. Stephen Bonnet? Bonnet nods, bows.
Wait, you're Irish. God, I don't even know.
Just say the words, David. Just say the words.
Yeah, pleased to make your acquaintance, sir. I'm a leprechaun. I'm going with it.
A gambling man, are you?
Goodness me.
Mr. Bonnet.
Apologies to every person out there.
Bonnet smiles. And David is smiling now. I don't know if it's to do with the scene or nervousness, but he is smiling.
I've been known to bet on the facts, but truth be told, I find the sight of two women engaged in such a violent combat vulgar.
Superb.
That wasn't bad. Wow.
You did that really, I really loved that.
Suddenly that audition for Peaky Blinders you want to do again.
Yeah.
Wait a second. Hang on.
I'm impressing myself here. Let's see if I can keep this going.
Absolutely. Let's just keep going.
Please.
Forbes indicates the two women fighters, one large, one scrawny, but very much holding her own.
One claims that the other cost her 20 shillings, stole her fancy. Still her fancy man two nights in a row. Whoever prevails keeps the winnings.
You just interrupted me and
just keep it going.
No excuse.
Stay there, David.
We're in the dynamo now.
Far from being the gentler sex today, then again, I'm not one to pass up a good wager.
My money's on the fair-haired damsel.
I put a stake on the red-haired harlot.
They watch the fight for a beat. God, it's just brutal. Blood is flying. A drunken gentleman of means, Mr. Marsden, rudely cheers on larger prostitutes. Prostitutes.
How is it you know Mr. Turnbull?
Mr. Bonnet has facilitated the transport of various proprietary goods for me and many others who wish to avoid the king's levies. He's very discreet in his dealings.
One good turn.
Why didn't I do it like that?
Indeed.
Because that was terrible. I really want to take that back. I feel like I sounded like Willy Wonka or something. It didn't really come out right. I was actually trying to channel you.
No, no, it was lovely. I honestly,
really?
Thank
you. All right.
Indeed. I'm glad we have. How shall I put it? Untethered you from your past, Mr. Bonnet. This is a very deferential Bonnet. It's clear he's bought himself some protection among some prominent people in Wilmington. He's a wanted man, after all.
It would be a pleasure doing business with you, Mr. Forbes, should the need arise.
I'll surely keep that in mind, Mrs. Doubtfire.
Bonnet's still working. It's good.
It's Doubtfire. Look, Doubtfire is my Scottish.
I thought I was doing Mrs. Doubtfire just then. But I mean, anyway, I mean, I'm. You can have Doubtfire if you like. Right.
Oh, so you use Doubtfire as well. Yeah, that's my in into Scottish. I mean, that's well established. I've talked about this before. I'm not really sure what I'm channeling with Irish here. I think I'm channeling the guy from the Lucky Charms commercials, the cereal. I don't even know if you have that in the UK.
Wow.
Of all the variety of Irish accents you could have picked, it was the Lucky Charms commercial. I think that's superb.
I have very, very sophisticated, let's say, Epicurean artistic tastes, and cereal commercials is where I get a lot of my artistic influences from.
Big up the capitalism.
Yeah. I've got the what?
Big up the capitalism, the commercial Lucky Charm. No problem. Lovely. I love it.
Oh, yeah. No, I really do a mean Tony Tiger.
Look forward to that as the scene moves on. So, Bonnet's still working as a smuggler, despite the fact that he's keeping more highbrow company. We're on the prostitutes as they viciously just pummel each other. The crowd, you see, I'm really trying to paint it here. God,
yeah.
Just, it's just spurted all over the walls. It's out of people's arms. It's horrible. You don't want to see it. Oh, God. The crowd, including Forbes, Turnbull and Bonnet, whoop. And woo! Cheer. Ooh, the larger woman goes down unconscious, not surprisingly. Any prostitute raises her arms in victory.
What did I tell you? I know a winner when I see one.
Bonnet collects his winnings. Marsden, who's lost his own wager and is a sore loser, makes a passing snide comment.
And I know a cheater when I see one.
Marsden eyes the larger prostitute on the floor, being revived by someone.
Clearly you know the woman.
What are you implying?
We were in league with her. You knew when she'd go down.
I assure you, you're quite mistaken.
Bonnet takes his wings and attempts to move past Marsden.
Oh, damn your eyes, sir. I prefer to lose with honour rather than win by trickery.
You've insulted my honour, sir. Let us settle this like gentlemen.
Fighting words.
Okay.
Goodness me. Very much. Should we finish off? Because I want to see what the denouement of this. I want to hear it.
I'm really quite happy with what I've been doing, so if I get the chance to...
Oh, let's just finish off. Let's just finish off right to the end. So moments later, the clashing of swords as an impromptu duel takes place between Bonnet and Marsden. Men wager on the outcome of this contest as eagerly as they waged on the bare-knuckle prostitutes. Bonnet gets the upper hand and disarms Marsden. Ha-ha! Wounding him in the thigh. Yeah! Marsden sinks to his knees and yields. Instead of accepting the surrender, Bonnet shows his true colours as he performs an act of such cruelty that it makes a deep impression upon all who witness it.
'Tis not my eyes that will be damned, sir.
Oh!
That was pirate. That was that good. Came a bit
no,
pirate.
Well, that's, that was good.
It touched upon West Country. I will be honest there.
Thank you. But I think it was warranted. I think it needed that. He went full pirate in that moment, and that's what I tried to go with.
Part of this cast is coming out of Bristol, I suppose. We can have West Country in there today, I think. You know, why not?
Absolutely.
And look,
Absolutely.
Tim, at the end of the day, the man who played the character just gave me his approval, and I think that's really all that matters in this moment.
Do you know what? I think you're absolutely right.
Thank you.
We move on. Bonnet has already sheathed his sword, but he takes his knife out now and draws the blade across Marsden's eyes, twisting it in such a fashion as not only to blind him, but to mutilate him and make him an object of horror and pity. Marsden screams in agony and then faints. Bonnet wipes his knife on Marsden's shirt, then sheathes it. Forbes looks on aghast. Turnbull regards Bonnet with confusion. 'Tis unlike you, Bonnet. But why not kill the man outright?
I considered it, but I must set a better example.
Oh, he's grown into this. Oh, God.
Oh, yeah.
I am a father now.
Bonnet walks away, his words leaving a chill in his wake. Fade out. End of act.
I know you felt that chill.
Mic drop.
Lucky Charms will never taste the same again.
No, it never will, because you'll be thinking exactly. of Bonnet. Won't you? Everyone will be thinking of Bonnet and Lucky Charms. Hopefully, if I've done my job right.
That's a brilliant scene. Was that fun to film? Because it's great fun to read, and it really comes off the page, and it's incredibly visceral, which I'm a big fan of. All of that is fantastic. Good fun to film.
Yeah, it was good fun to film. I think, I think one of the things about playing this character in general is he always gets these sort of moments. You don't always see him that often, but when he pops up, it's normally, it's making a statement. And as you say, it's an incredibly visceral scene. And it's not until, to be fair, that whole moment with the eyes, cutting that out, it wasn't actually until we got into rehearsing that fight sequence and the Apollo and I that we sort of started working out how gruesome it really was. But I think that's one of the great things about some of the Outlander writing is that it could be one thing on a page, but it's not until with this scene in particular, you get down to it, and it was a sort of hot cauldron mess of activity. There was so many extras on that day. This fight was breaking out, these really two gnarly stunt women who were pretty much going at each other for about an hour. Yeah, it was really like, it was like turning up to watch a UFC fight.
That's what it looked like. It definitely looked like
that. Yeah, it was like that. Yeah. It was a good scene to shoot. It's funny, those scenes. I don't know how you guys feel about it, but from an acting point of view, when you maybe haven't been there the whole time, and you have to there was a big emphasis on the day to do with the reveal, and it's obviously signposted in the script, and
behold Bonnet,
and that was kind of that put a bit of a strange pressure on things, and Stephen Wolfenden was sort of very determined to make the right choice in shots in order to make sure this reveal was a big deal without also being a big deal. You don't want to be sort of twiddling my invisible moustache at the same time. But there was that I wouldn't say I struggled with, but I tried to. I find that a bit of a thing to get my head around, because you are, you have to forget about all of that, but at the same time you're surrounded by 150 people, and there is suddenly this focus on this one small moment. But it was a good scene. It was good fun to shoot, and we had a good team of actors on. Billy Boyd was on that day playing Forbes. It was a lot of fun. And also, I think so. I'm rambling on.
I did have a question though. Just interrupt you for a sec, because back to these moments where it says behold Bonnet. Do you reckon that the extras, 150 extras, knew who you were? Are they going when they have this moment, behold Bonnet? Are they thinking, who even is Bonnet?
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Because I've seen these things in the script where they're like, and Lord John enters, and you get this big entrance, and then you're wondering in the minds of everyone else who's in the stage, like, did they actually?
I think for this example, I felt that it was more about. That moment in a for the camera, I suppose, rather than for the extras, because I don't think the extras even needed to know who Bonnet was in this situation, and actually probably they were told they didn't necessarily know until the fight unraveled, and then you get third AD. I always think it's such a tough job for a third AD to whip up a crowd.
Exactly. Yeah.
And have to do it for hours on end, in these big extra scenes where you're seeing fight, and they have to keep repeating these, you've got to really go for this guy, or really support this guy, or try and whip up this frenzy.
Well, I think that's it, isn't it? Because you said it yourself, it's about you don't want to act the moment. You don't want to endow this moment with more importance than it is. It's almost like you can't bring the Stephen Bonnet and give him that sense of like, behold Stephen Bonnet. It's something that the crowd has to create for you. And that's something that, if you want to explain that as you were saying, the third AD does it. You want to explain what they do?
What a third AD does, you mean?
Yeah, a third assistant director.
Sorry, third assistant director. Yeah, I mean, they have quite a tough job. I mean, they are the first assistant director's right-hand person, I suppose. And whenever you're involved, I mean, they deal mainly with cast on the floor as well, and they're sort of the go-between to many departments. However, let's say we're in a scenario as this scene described, or any other big scene involving a lot of supporting artists, then it is normally on them to be guiding exactly where they need extras to be going, to what they need to be doing, at what point to shout, at what point to be a part of the scene and to give that life. And it's a really tough ask. You know, if you've got 100 people there who are there all day from 6 o'clock in the morning, and they're a variety of ages and abilities as actors, as people, it's quite a tall order for them, but also for the third assistant director to keep them bubbly. And also then you fall into the danger, don't you, of when you're trying to whip up this crowd and then they get so excited that then they're sort of talking and shouting over the top of things. And but there's the guy, who's the chap who directed, is it Todd Haynes, the director? Doesn't he really gets all of his extras quite involved, I think. I think he gives them like an actual character, I suppose, which I think is quite interesting.
Greta Gerwig did it for Little Women as well, to create that relationship of sisters and to create all those kind of little pockets of people. She did the same thing. She basically just sort of said, you're going to live with each other, and all you people are just going to be, I'm going to throw problems in. You're going to have to deal with these things as you would as a group for as long as possible. And it does, it kind of creates a real vitality to a scene, because you just kind of look, you almost feel that everybody here aren't acting. They're just, because they're so in it. But it's being included. I think that was always the thing I've found with dealing with supporting artists, is everybody, like when we were doing the war sequences, the battle sequences, the people that were the soldiers were everybody treated them like soldiers. So there was two guys who were role players. Like their thing is being role players. They dress up of a weekend in red coats and they go out on a battlefield. And so they would want to be addressed as sergeant, and they would treat their troops and then they would show me as the general, would you like to inspect your troops, sir? Before, no cameras, nobody there, nobody doing anything. And so you would go, okay, yeah, okay, I'll inspect the troops. Thank you. Thank you, sir. If you'd like to stand here, this is, and then treat them all.
But that was led by them. That was led by the supporting artist.
It was the production saying to them, your role players, treat it as you would of a weekend. You know what to do, because this is what you do. And they would know all the ins and outs about musketry and all these things. But it adds so much more to a scene.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, incredible. Really incredible. But it adds so much more. It kind of creates more of a depth of world where you can look at anything within that shot and people are doing the things that they would potentially be doing in reality. Same as this sequence, is there's so much to look at. You've got the main core of the scene and then you have all these other little stories going on. And if people are just standing around holding a flag and going, isn't this fun? We're in Outlander. You can tell. You can tell. You could go, I can tell that guy there is just trying to find out where the camera is. And that is such a difference. I think it really lifts it off the page and off the screen.
I think the including point's really interesting, Tim, because I think that probably put hitting the nail on the head, isn't it? It's because if you feel you've got a sense of purpose, no matter how great or small your involvement might be in that moment, and you get that as an actor. I mean, it's not just as a supporting artist. You come into a scene where, you know, I've done things where I've been very much on the fringes, on the sidelines. But if you have a director or a production that gives you detail and gives you a purpose, then you feel beyond what you've already worked on, then you feel like you're part of the team, and then you want to give more, and then you want to, but you're finding that balance between giving too much or too little. But if you're given that clear direction, that clear purpose, then I think that's of course it gives that life you're talking about.
Now I have to admit to a kind of embarrassing, I think it's embarrassing, interaction I had with some supporting artists in one of these episodes of Outlander. Embarrassing because I think I kind of overstepped my mark in terms of, you know, what I'm supposed to do as an actor. I started thinking, you know, they weren't giving me enough Lord John. They needed to really kind of respect the Lord John, and they weren't giving me enough. So it was the scene where I'm dancing. It's Jocasta's wedding, and we're doing this dance. And then at the end of the dance, I needed, in the scene, I couldn't solve it. Like, I needed to get away from the scene and then talk to Jamie and Claire. And I needed the supporting artist to, like, treat Lord John like he was like the hottest thing ever. Like, just treat me like you really just really wanted to dance with me, and now you have to, like, I have to distract myself from you. But that's what I had in my head, and it kind of was there on the page, but the director wasn't going to direct the supporting artist with that because, you know, essentially that's my own narrative. So I decided, you know what, I think I really have to, so I have to solve this myself. So I went over to the supporting artist and I said, look, in this moment, you think Lord John's just like really, really hot, okay, and you just really want to dance with him, and you're really upset when I don't dance with you. So if you can kind of add that into your work there, I think that'd be really great. And you know what? They did it, and I think the scene turned out great. But the embarrassing thing is that I had to tell them to, you know, treat me and endow me with that. And sometimes, you know, the supporting artists will be like, you know, more than ready to play the game, which they did in this instance very graciously. Or other times, you know, if I told any other actor to do that, you know, Stephen Bonnet, Ed, would you treat Lord John just really hot in this thing? Can you pretend that?
I mean, I always did think of Lord John in my scenes. Any scene I was ever in, I was always thinking about how hot Lord John was. That was the big ruse.
It was a driving factor. That's why I'm still hanging around Wilmington.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And we never had any awkward moments on set because we, you know, we had that understanding. And Tim, I know.
Was an understanding.
Yeah. We never had that conversation, Tim, because we already knew.
We knew this. As soon as our eyes caught each other in some Jamaican bar, we thought, yes, I'll see you again. And then it's left there. It's left there, just hanging, it's tantalizingly hanging. Wonderful stuff, really.
Beautiful moments.
So I want to touch now a bit on your career, Ed. You had a really interesting career, and I want to have to come clean a bit here to being a little bit intimidated by you at first, because there were these stories going around that you're like this really, you know, serious actor who's into his craft, and you're like a bit method, and you really. I was actually familiar with your work before coming on set, and I was like, who's this really super successful guy that's coming on Outland? And that's why I'm really excited to have you on the show, but because you've experienced like a lot straight out of the gate, didn't you? You went straight on to like a huge, huge movie. That was one of the first things you did.
Yeah. Well, I was sort of minding my own business at school. And yeah, the first thing I did in front of a camera, apart from a short film where I was doing something weird in a public loo, but that was when I was about 15. No one's ever seen that. My first ever proper professional gig was a film about a young boy and his dragon, which was based on these books, this Aragorn inheritance series. And I was suddenly, from being at school one day as a 17-year-old cheeky so-and-so, I was suddenly doing being a lead in a very, very big film. It was a very, I'm going to use so many cliches potentially, it was incredibly surreal from start to finish. Whether I don't know about having a successful career or not, I don't really know that at the moment, but I think that it was a baptism of fire. I think everything about that film and everything about the 18 months of my life, I suppose it does sound very cliche. I wanted to be an actor from a very young age, and I was very fortunate. The schools I went to, I had very good drama teachers who kind of shaped and guided and molded that, and allowed me to try things out. And then this opportunity came in, and actually it was, although without having done that film or been in that experience, working with some of the people that were in that job, I actually feel it left me quite scarred as a result, because it was suddenly going from like standing start to like Gear 5 and trying to and being all the things that go with it, being sort of all the flying around the world, all the trapping element, which is, you know, not is lovely, and it's a huge perk to this job at times, but also it's not really what this job is about from my point of view. And I think that it was such an alien experience for me, and it was for my family as well. You know, we didn't really know how to handle it. I don't think I became a it wasn't like a nightmare with it or anything like that. I just didn't. It was so overwhelming at all times. You know, you go from being a schoolboy to being with adults who could do whatever they want, and you're within that environment. And I didn't really know how to handle it.
Was there ever a sense that, you know, with everything happening so quickly for you, that it hadn't been sort of entirely earned? You know, like, I mean, how much of that early success did you think was down to luck? How much was down to talent? And how much was hard work?
I would say getting that moment, getting that chance was 98.5% luck, probably. I don't think there's much talent involved. And I think, it's a funny thing. I think the one, not analogy I always come up with it, but I never went to drama school, and I still have a huge, huge chip on my shoulder about that. And I probably always will. And I wish I had. And there was a moment after that film, I should have gone, actually, you're 18, you've got, let's try and get into a drama school and see where you can go. I didn't. But I think the thing about doing that sort of role in that environment, it wasn't earned. And I still feel it wasn't earned. And I feel that, you know, I don't know quite, I think we've talked a little bit about this, David, before, but I don't quite know how it works in Australia. I know the states are very good at giving people opportunities and chucking them at it and going, right, you can take on the world with one chance. Tim, you may feel differently in the UK, and this is the one thing I noticed, is that most actors, not all, go through the normal route, you know, whether it be drama school, and then they might get a few opportunities to do a bit of theatre, and then they might get a chance to maybe do an episode here or there of a long running soap, and then they might do an independent film, or, you know, there's obviously meant that's one example. There's many journeys, but it's incremental, and it's allowing yourself to make mistakes. And I think that was one of the biggest issues for me, was it wasn't incremental. It was like, there you go, and it's every scene, and it was huge exposure. And some people can really fly with that. There's some incredible actors who have started at that age and have flown with it. And I wasn't. I sort of sank, and it really it messed my head up for quite a long time.
But yet you went to work alongside some people who really embody all those attributes of, you know, hard work and talent and maybe a bit of luck. You worked with Maggie Smith, Hugh Bonneville, Mark Rylance. What did you learn from these actors, and what did they teach you about the meaning of success?
I think actually when you're talking about that caliber of actor, success is never really mentioned. And it's not about what do they define by it. I think they inherently, I mean, those particular actors, they inherently behave in a certain way that it is all about the work and all about being professional. And don't get me wrong, they're great fun. It's not like they're completely intensely serious the whole time, but they value the work and the craft. People like, I'll be honest, you know, someone like Maggie, I didn't have a great deal. It was mainly a lot of watching. I spent a lot of time watching her and watching how she conducts herself. And to see someone, you know, I don't really want to mention age so much, but of her vintage, and to have, oh, my fucking dog. to have the experience she's had, but still almost on every single take, there'll be something original, and just trying to mix it up and shape it up. And I think that's one way to not necessarily be successful, but at least to enjoy the work you're doing. And it, you know, it's not about going completely off piste all the time, but I feel you have to, what I'm trying to say is you could see there is someone there who is still relishing the chance to work and relishing the chance to throw things out and try things out. Cause I think if you're keeping that, you know, ingenuity and freshness to whatever you're trying to portray, then I think that will lead you to some form of success, I suppose. And it's hard to define success as well as an actor. I think it's quite a subjective thing. You know, it's all, we live in a world that, certainly in the Western world, that really pushes on this idea of, you know, success being material potentially. And actually, maybe as actors, as artists, as it doesn't have to be. And it's not about necessarily names and lights and achieving things that on paper look like they are ticking boxes, but actually, is it more Is it more to do with getting enjoyment from what you're doing and getting satisfaction? That's a successful time. I think if you can finish a job, no matter how great or small it is, and feel that you've given something that you haven't done before, well, it's not always going to happen. You are at the mercy of the roles that are presented to you via agents, via producers, etc. But I think if you can try and find something that a challenge each time that you've can feel like you've lifted something from yourself that you haven't done before, then I think that's a mark of success. But
so you started out with these, you know, ideas of success. You're on this $100 million Hollywood movie, whatever, and I'm just, that probably set up your expectations of your future. And I'm thinking now that you've gone through that, what are your expectations of you know, what you want from your career now, having this new understanding of what success means? Do you want to come back and work your way to another big Hollywood movie? Would that be interesting to you again?
Yeah, it would. But I think I would, I don't want to say I would caution. It's not like we're there with that much caution at all. I've got two small children. There's mouths to be fed. But I think it's. I am really trying my hardest to make sure whatever I keep doing or whatever it is in the future is something that I've not. It's not necessarily as simple for. I'm probably not explaining myself very well saying it, you know, about not it being something I haven't done before. But I've got to feel invested in it. And don't get me wrong. Look, you know, I as the next person. Like a good lifestyle, I'm fortunate to lead a very comfortable, nice lifestyle. However, it's not being the be all and end all. I've been on jobs where I've been wholly unsatisfied because I've chased the wrong thing in it. And I think I will be dictated to by a script and by a character. And I think, you know, it's a hard balance because I don't want to get to a position where what you don't want to be is you don't want to be one of these actors who gets further into his 30s, into 40s and starts resenting others or becoming bitter and twitter, which I think is a very easy thing. And I want to always try and maintain the enjoyment of it. And at the moment I am, and it took quite a long time to find enjoyment again. It's only really been in the last few years, I suppose, that I've actually maybe grown in confidence enough to believe I'm capable of doing some good work. And I think that's been a quite a lovely discovery. It's not about saying I'm any good, but it's just having my own self-belief to think that I'm capable of doing something. And I think that will dictate how I pick certain roles. But as I say, at the same time, like, not to bring it into the attention of what's going on at the moment, but who knows what's going to unfold. You know, if I don't work for 7 months, then I'll do anything. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
What have you got?
Exactly.
What have you got for me? Exactly. I'll do it. It's not a problem.
You want me over there? No problem. So yeah. Clothes off, is it? No, okay, fine. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Fabulous. I came in like that anyway, expecting it. But it reminds me of the very similar to, I think it was Peter Cushing that once said, you know, that as an actor, if you're working, you're a success. And I think that kind of old school attitude, I think Alec Guinness also said the same kind of thing, is that there is so much uncertainty is built into our very fabric of what we do, because you always know there's uncertainty. No matter how good the job is, like the film that you started on, no matter how good it is, it will end because it has to. And so with that, those mechanics behind it, if you're working, then you are a success. For me, that's what it boils down to, is you're working, you're a success. And if you can find the enjoyment, which is what where you're coming from as well, then you are truly a man of riches, I think, because this is an exciting job. And if you can have fun and enjoy it and be playful when you're in your 80s and 90s and still find the fun and the enjoyment, then you have done extremely well, because it's a difficult industry. It looks glamorous, but it's incredibly difficult and it can be very draining. And so I think those little moments where you can sit back and go, God, this is fun, isn't it? And especially if you're around friends. It's one of the things about the sort of the Outlander cast is that people were very nice. And that can be a rarity. To kind of sit down and just have a chat with someone is great. You've got to think, God, this is lovely. It's a lovely day outside. We're dressed up, putting on silly voices, and we're doing, you know, this wonderful thing, and then we get to go and do what we want to do. And that's, you know, that's fantastic, I think.
Two things come to my mind. I think, like, for actors, I think most of us aren't very financially motivated. We're not really driven by money. Trying to be responsible and having kids and so forth, having that, balancing that on the one hand, and then trying to make the right choice financially, but also trying to feed the artist. And I think the other thing that came to mind was, having gratitude and having gratitude as an actor is a remarkably difficult thing for us. Someone once told me a thing that a grouping of actors, a grouping of dogs is a pack, a murder of crows. It's a complaint of actors.
Yeah, a whinge of actors.
A whinge of actors, because we always find things to complain about and never have gratitude for what we do. And when you see people who have really successful careers and having still coming in with a lot of gratitude and for what they do, then and love for what they do, and maintaining that in spite of whatever challenges, and they're probably very minimal, we're not getting the right coffee sometimes, it's not getting the script's not right or something, we find anything to complain about.
I mean, the script's acceptable, I suppose. The coffee not being right might
that's a deal breaker right there. But it's like that, it reminds me of that actor's joke of the guy coming in to see his partner, and he says, most incredible thing has happened, I got the part. Yeah, it's the lead. It's with De Niro. It's going to be 6 months shoot in Hawaii. It's just incredible. I'm being paid $25 million. I am. And do you know what the best part is? She says, no, what is it? She goes, I've got tomorrow off. And that is very much the actor mentality. This is amazing. Yeah. When's lunch?
It's quite often you get a job coming and you go, Oh no, but that's our holiday. Oh, we've got our holiday to so and so of that. Yeah. Oh no, but that means we're going to have to cancel. Oh, that's a shame. You've not worked for 6 months, Ed. I know, but I was really looking forward to that 2 week holiday
in Spain. This would have been it. But it is tricky because with actors, you're either there all the time or you're not, and that's a very difficult sort of work life balance to get, because most other friends that live do normal jobs. You have set times. You're sort of like, right, well, we will have 2 weeks here and nothing will interfere with that, but there will be 2 weeks there and 2 weeks here, and we get all these moments. And yet the classic thing with actors is, the surest way to get a job is to book a holiday, as that happens just constantly, because it's just such a movable feast.
I guess one of the interesting things about being there, what you're saying, Tim, we're not, we are either there a lot or we're not there at all. It makes it tricky, because one of the things I'm trying to find a way to work, especially with Dorky mentioned having smaller children, is that is learning to appreciate that time you've got, not necessarily with them, but with yourself. And I know we're all trying to probably do that at the moment, but it's amazing. There was an actor once said to me, he said, I wish in those 3 months I had off, I knew I was going to get a job at the end of that 3 months, because I wouldn't be spending those 3 months worrying about when I was going to get a job.
I wanted to switch gears for a second. I wanted to talk music, because I know that's something that you and I and Tim, we all have in common, is this obsession with music and using music as a way of getting into character. I understand something that you do, Ed. For instance, I read somewhere that you created a playlist to help you build your character of Stephen Bonnet, and that you were listening to a lot of, was it Van Morrison and Oasis? Am I right?
Yeah, there was a lot of Van Morrison and Oasis, yeah.
And I was just wondering, how do you use music to help you get into character? How are you using that?
I always have. I mean, yes, as you rightly said, music's been a huge part of my life, and it will always be a huge part. Part of it's a fun thing in terms of creating a playlist to understand a character. You're talking about a character who's set in 1700s, 18th century. It's quite tricky to, you're not going to, there was no Oasis and Van Morrison, but it's just, I find it useful to set a tone or to try and create a way of thinking and being. I think actually particularly on the whole Oasis thing, that was something to do because I was watching a lot of Liam Gallagher videos and interviews when I was sort of prepping Stephen Bonnet, just because I found him quite an interesting character study in how he comes across and his physicality. I thought he was quite, I find him quite fascinating in a way, just on a sort of behavioural way. But I think, yeah, music's always been a big part. And whether it be looking at music from an era, you know, I remember when doing Downton, for example, there was a lot of early jazz coming into play, a lot of Al Jolson and things changing up, a lot of the sort of movement of like Charleston was a big dance move that started coming in. So as a result, I started looking into that quite a bit. But I find it an incredibly relaxing tool and powerful tool. And it's not, you know, and there's elements of music that's incredibly personal to me that I like to use. And it's not that I like to always shut myself away on headphones. I used to do quite a lot of that, but I find that can, for me now, I will still do it, but I find it can be quite debilitating in the sense you can kind of shut yourself off too much from the environment you're working in. However, I do like to, you know, throughout the day, there is a lot of noise throughout the day in on a film set in particular, you know, of course, less so in theatre. So I do find it incredibly useful, whether it be from relaxing or just setting a tone, or, and also for whatever work I may have tried to put into a role, just to sort of let it maybe seep into myself a bit more.
I'm totally with you on that. I have people often ask me, I've always got my earbuds in when I'm on set, and people come up to me and they say, what are you listening to? And I'm always approach that question with a degree of dread and embarrassment, because actually what I'm usually listening to is Usher or 90s slow dance R&B, which has absolutely nothing to do with Lord John.
Or does it?
But for me, it's about getting a sense of into my body and it helps loosen me up. Tim, what are you listening to?
I listen to a lot of English folk music. Don't know why, just suddenly really have got into it of late. So I listen to a lot of that, traditional kind of English ballads, Scottish ballads, things like that. I have no idea why. It's just, maybe it's this kind of the movement of the spheres of where we are that has just kind of infused that sort of earthiness. I'm finding a real, because I grew up in the country and I've always gone, I don't want to be in the country. I hate being in the country. It's just, it's too minimal. There's nothing to do. You're 20 miles in the nearest town. I want to get away from that. And so I came to London, and of late, maybe it's having kids as well and having no outside space being in London, is that I've really harked back to the music of where I'm from, which is very, even with the tiny village that I grew in, had a very strong folk element, a lot of tales and stories and oddness to it and things like that. And I've really kind of tapped back into that.
Where was that, Tim?
It was in Hertfordshire, a little village in Hertfordshire, bizarrely enough, where Michael, who plays Lieutenant Knox, actually is from the next village. Or had just bought a house in the next village when we started doing Outlander. So all things kind of evolve. And there's a lot of kind of weirdness to that particular part of town. It's where there's a very ancient route called the Icknield Way that drives through. It's the ancient Roman routes that would link the ley lines and all those kind of things. But it's got a very strong folk heritage. So I think I'm tapping back into that. So I'm listening to a lot of that. Much to the wonderment of my kids. Which, as you can imagine, getting in the car of, what are we going to listen to, Daddy? We're going to listen to Shirley Collins. This is quite a depressing piece. It's about, it's about famine. So how about we all sing along to that? I don't want to, Daddy. Why are you doing this?
Well, at least you understand where your musical choices are coming from. People come into my trailer and I'm pumping like Boys to Men and they're thinking, who is this guy? I have no idea. But I want to talk about villains because, of course, you're playing a villain on Outlander. And when I think of some of the best villains that I know, there's those like Darth Vader, T-1000, Jason Voorhees, who on the one hand elicit this really visceral response of fear and hate in their audiences, but they don't really have a very complex psychology. And then on the other hand, you have villains like Loki, the Joker, or even Gollum, who have these deep emotional reasons for their behavior and are essentially just sort of damaged people lashing out and taking out their pain on the world and other people. I was wondering, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think a villain's job is to be hated or to be understood?
That's a good question. I think it's potentially circumstantial. I think that And it all depends on what's being presented. I think in an ideal situation, whether it's about being understood, I'm not necessarily sure if it's ever. I don't necessarily think that every villainous character has to be understood, but I think the for me, the more interesting ones to watch and to read about are ones where you can understand some sort of, you know, understand the human behavior and understand the psychology of what has brought them to be the way they are. Now, some people are potentially just born a certain way, but some of them are, it's from a plethora of things from nature versus nurture. There's that old adage argument about it. But I think that for me, from a watching point of view, it's just when characters are, you know, when the villains are more one-dimensional, then it's just about being the bad guy. I tend to find that less interesting. I'll be honest, I think that's true of either end of the spectrum. I think even if you're into, I think the good guys as well. I feel from an acting point of view.
Well, I think we want our heroes, you know, relatable or flawed, and we want our villains kind of understandable, I think, a lot of the time. Otherwise, we get these very strong binaries of good and evil. Do you agree?
Yeah, completely. And I think that's certainly for a younger audience, that's a dangerous thing to be teaching. Not a dangerous thing to be teaching, but I think it's better rounded if we are keeping it slightly more fluid, I suppose. I'm not necessarily ambiguous, but I think if we can try and understand human behaviour on more than just a one note level, then I think it's more helpful to us as people anyway.
Well, who's the bigger villain here? Is it Tryon or is it Bonnet?
What do you think, Tim?
I'll tell you what, I think we serve two different types of villainry.
Yeah.
I think Tryon probably taps into the villainry of establishment, of like a wide-arcing unpleasantness. The British Empire that just did what it wanted to do in order to satisfy itself. Whereas Bonnet, this is from my... Please tell me if I'm wrong on this, has an air of very real threat. Like, he is very much, this is someone that you are wary of. He reminds me a little of, in Gangs of New York, the Daniel Day-Lewis character. And what I adore about that, and the same way I love about your character, is I don't want to be in the same room with them because I don't know what you're going to do. And I think that is just such... It's fascinating to watch. Then when you do put someone in a room with a character like that, it's like putting them in with a wild tiger. The tiger could just walk around and just kind of look at you, or it could just tear you to shreds in a moment. And I think that's the difference. With Tryon, you feel you maybe could strike a deal if there's a benefit somewhere. He's not wild. He's a government man. He's probably quite a petty man in many respects, whereas Bonnet has more status and power, but it's far more volatile in differing ways. What are your thoughts?
I think I agree with you, and I feel that. But with that, I think that what are the longer lasting effects of that? Someone like Tryon, who is more cerebral, and what they are doing has like huge ramifications for society. That kind of, you know, that, as you say, that someone who is in establishment and who is part of that sinister element of the British Empire, to have that. And you see it unfold even today with people who are in positions of power and authority, and how that can be exploited. And even if they may be on their own in a certain situation, they may not have the backbone that they need. But when they are in power, they can create huge fear because of what they're doing, and it's over a period of time, which I think is incredibly dangerous. Yeah, and I think, but Bonnet, that his actions have huge impacts on the individuals he harms, but is it more contained? So I guess they have a different. They're looking at it from the effects of their sinister ways. They're on slightly different scales as well, I suppose.
So there we go. Two villains having a discussion about who's worse, and probably doing it in the most diplomatic, friendly way possible.
You're more evil. No, you're more evil.
I love how evil you are.
Well, I want to say we have often have very high expectations of our villains. I think we expect them to be very complex and bold, and a villain can make or break a TV show or a movie, yet we don't typically give our villains much screen time. I'm thinking, for example, I don't know if you know this, but in the movie The Dark Knight, Heath Ledger's Joker appeared for only 33 minutes of the 2-hour runtime of the film. And in Silence of the Lambs, Anthony Hopkins, they both earned Oscars for their performance. Anthony Hopkins, Hannibal Lecter was only on film for 16 minutes.
Wow.
So, yeah. Well, it seems to me that the same could be said of Stephen Bonn in many ways. So, you have a very short, quick, impactful appearance. So, my question is, how difficult is it to create a convincing villain when you're typically given so little screen time?
I feel that it stems from writing, doesn't it? I think that's what you're always looking for. And I think, as we touched on earlier, about when you're given the chance to play certain characters, but you're having to make an impact. Whether I've made an impact or not, he is a character, certainly does in terms of writing, and I think it stems from that. That allows certainly me to have the room to explore. There's quite a lot on the page for me to explore, essentially, and I have to sort of be very thankful to the writers for that. And I guess that's what's happening with these other characters. You don't really want to have, unless it is about them, you don't really want to be seeing the villain the whole time, and nor should you. But I feel that it has to stem from having, a rich piece of writing there, The great thing about doing this role is that if you don't feel you have got quite enough for any reason, or if you feel you can't quite make the impact you might want to, and it's just one short moment. I mean, certainly in this series just done, a lot of my episodes, it was literally one scene in an episode. I don't know how you felt that Diana Gabaldon handled it for Tryon and Lord John, but certainly from Bonnet's point of view, I quite often went back to just the character description. And also, I think I kept coming back to previous work I'd done from the last season, from series four, and just kept coming back to that. And I felt that if I'd done the work properly and I'd found my way in with him, It does become easier, especially when you, and that's one of the great things about doing television that repeats itself. And I'm sure you guys must feel the same. Is when you put on the costume, it is like slipping into a sort of pair of old slippers in a way. You can sort of you feel connected quite quickly, I find, with a character you've played before. There's a muscle memory there, which I've completely rambled my way through that answer. I'm so sorry.
I think we're all in the same position here. We all have, smaller parts, but I put a lot of pressure on myself in scenes, especially when, even if they're one word scenes, which we can frequently have, just do the one look.
But they're the hardest, exactly. They're the hardest.
Thank you. They are the hardest. There's nothing harder in this world when you look at something and I think on paper, that's easy. You come in, you say, the morning papers are here. I can look at that on the day, not a problem, but it is the hardest thing to retain character and retain all the other things rather than a four-page scene where you're discussing whatever it is you're discussing. It's easier to approach because there's so much to go on and you can have moments of quiet and pause and you can really kind of take you through it. But when you just kind of come in, say a line and leave, the hardest thing in the world. I suppose it's all down is making early choices. Make early choices about what your character does or is like, and certain little things that make the character memorable and make the character, yes, that's what this is. I think for me, that's sort of one of the things I sort of play on.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to sort of lead into this next question, though. With so much evil and adversity happening to the characters on Outlander on the show, do you ever worry that Stephen Bonnet will have a lasting impact on the characters in Outlander? I mean, how do you hope his character will be remembered?
I wouldn't lean on thinking about that too much because for me personally, I set myself a very clear way of how I want to approach something, and if I've I don't want to say tick the boxes, but if I have done that, then that's all I can offer. Even with a character like this, you don't do it to sort of leave a legacy of what that character was or what it what he represented. You just have to play the truth of what's presented to you. And, you know, and of course, it's as you say, this huge adversity comes to the principles of this show. And that's part of it. But, you know, and you have to accept that you are, you know, that you will be at some point replaced by another adversary. But I wouldn't want to think about that too much or dwell on that in any way. And actually coming right back to how, you know, one of your first questions, it comes back to the enjoyment of it again. If I'm enjoying what I'm doing, then that is more than enough for me. And I just have to have satisfaction with that and be happy with the work that's been put forward. And if it works for people, great. If it doesn't work for others, then that's fine too.
Well, Ed, I can tell you something. It certainly works for us. And I just want to say thank you for your time. And thank your dog as well. I've loved hearing that. And the bin man. It's all been fabulous.
Postman, what else do we have? We had some kind of digital assistant.
Yeah,
it's a party.
Thank you so much for having me on board. And I can't apologise enough for my technical ineptitude early doors. And if I've mumbled and fluffed my way through it, apologies. But I've enjoyed having this couple of hours. It's been nice to talk to you both.
Yeah, it's been nice to catch up, exactly. If anything. Yeah. It's been lovely. But thank you. No, I personally think Stephen Bonnet is a truly memorable character because he is much like I was saying in Gangs of New York. He is very much that character, especially in my head. Thank you for being in the same room, but I wouldn't want to be in the same room as Stephen Bonnet, and that's for darn sure. But yeah,
this is about as close as we get.
This is a safe distance. So thank you. So Ed, thank you once again. And now we've reached that part of the show where we read listeners' letters. And this one I am very excited about as we have been asked to help someone. So I think we can really do this. So listen up, David. I think this is right down your alley. Now,
okay.
I always hear this song when listening to Outlander, but I can't find what it's called. So maybe you can help. Okay. It starts really low, and then it starts picking up, and then it goes a bit faster. Okay, so, and she's written it down. It goes a bit like this. Dun, 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 dun. Dun. Brackets goes a bit faster now. Dun, 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 dun. And then it goes, da 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 da. Sorry if this is bad information, but I'm sure if you really think about it, you could be some help. Many, many thanks, Melissa. Melissa, thank you for your question. Really, really good question. Really hope we can help. Problem is that there's quite a lot of episodes of Outlander, and you haven't actually said which episode or where it appears, or even in which series. It's pretty much just a collection of words that are very much open to interpretation as to actually how they go. If you can perhaps give us a bit more detail, any detail, basically, apart from what you've written, that would be probably pretty useful. Unless, David, you can throw some light on what on earth that is.
Well, Tim, I'm glad you asked. I do have a great musical ear. I'm pretty sure it's Clementine from that episode. With Roger and Bree. Oh, my darling Clementine.
Oh, I think you might be right.
Right, go back and read it again, Tim.
Go back. Hang on. Let's have a look at this. Okay, so it goes dun dun. I'm struggling.
That's where you're going wrong, guys. Dun 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 dun.
Yes, and then it gets and then she says quicker. Dun 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 dun. Ah, yes. Oh, that's very good, David. Well done.
Solved it. You're welcome.
That is very impressive. No, like, well, Melissa, there you go. Clementine, Roger and Bree, by the brilliant David Berry. Well done. What an ear. What an ear.
Easy one to miss. Oh, my darling Clementine.
Very impressive. Thank you for listening to Outcasts.
Please remember to rate, subscribe, and leave a review, as it all helps.
Follow us on our Instagram page at outcast.podcast for all the latest updates.
Or you can send us an email at outcastspodcastshow@gmail.com.
Every week, we shall select a question from one of our listeners to answer on the show.
The theme music is composed by Kieran Ledwidge. All views and opinions expressed on the show are our own and have no affiliation with the series of books written by Diana Gabaldone or the Sony Stars television show Outlander.
No animals were harmed in the making of this podcast. Although I did have a ham sandwich earlier. So,
see you next time.
See you next time.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.